Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 345, titled Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, subtitled Nation Building in the United States. This is the second program dealing with, really this is part two, dealing with this subject material. And as I indicated, and by the way, this is being recorded on January 27th of the year 2002, as I indicated in For the Record 344, an analysis of the political, economic, and military aspects of what took place on September 11th and afterward, it necessarily involves the overlap, the convergence of all of those various elements. And by the same token, analyzing the foreign and military, foreign policy and military aspects of the attacks and related elements, and the domestic aspects, to a certain extent, is also an artificial division. There are a number of key elements uniting these. One of these is the oil business and the fossil fuels business in general. Obviously, the Bush administration is inextricably linked with fossil fuels and energy. And economic policy with regard to the petroleum business and Saudi Arabia also is inextricably linked with not only the foreign policy and military aspects, but also the domestic aspects as well. We're going to be analyzing some of these areas of overlap and placing this in a larger context right now. In the aftermath of the September 11th attack on the Pentagon and World Trade Center, we have also seen an example of bioterrorism in the United States. Five people have died as a result of this bioterrorist attack with anthrax. And I would note that the news media and key Democratic senatorial leaders, including Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, were the focal points of these attacks. Not only has the evidence pointed in the direction of a U.S. military biological warfare lab as the origin of the specimens that were utilized, but now there is indication of an illicit access on the part of an individual or individuals unknown to that laboratory. In this context, bear in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario that I've been advancing for so long on this program. It is, I believe, not the novel. The book Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books, is not the novel that it's purported to be, but rather is a blueprint and a manifesto, sort of the Turner Diaries of the Bormann Organization. In Serpent's Walk, the SS goes underground at the end of World War II, which in fact happened. They build up a huge economic organization, which in fact happened, the remarkable and deadly Bormann Organization, about which I've spoken so many times. And they buy into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrate the United States Army and the intelligence services, note that, and following a biological warfare attack on the United States, after which martial law is declared, they take over the country. I've spoken in the past about the co-option of American media. We're going to talk more about that this evening on this broadcast, I should say. In the book Serpent's Walk, again, it is the underground SS economic organization that buys into the American opinion-forming media and uses it to change American public opinion. I guess one could say that they turn the Fourth Estate into a fifth column. Now, bearing in mind that the Serpent's Walk scenario also involves infiltrating the military and intelligence services in this country and launching a biological warfare attack on the United States and then having martial law declared and then taking over, consider the following. This is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, January 22nd of 2002. This is an article by Gwen Robinson in Washington. It's headlined, Anthrax and Ebola Samples, quote, Missing from U.S. Army Lab, unquote. And this article reads in part as follows, skipping down. The collective feeling of relief in Washington at the gradual subsiding of bioterrorism fears was broken yesterday by disclosures that specimens of anthrax, the Ebola virus, and other lethal pathogens were listed as missing after an audit of the U.S. Army's Biological Warfare Research Center at Fort Detrick in Maryland in the early 1990s. The report on the missing bacteria published by the Hartford Courant newspaper generated suspicions that U.S. government agencies withheld vital information about official research and possession of anthrax strains and other lethal bacteria. Skipping down, Federal authorities have said only that they think the anthrax letters were an act of domestic rather than international terrorism. The White House and other branches of U.S. government have said little about disclosures that many more U.S. public and private research laboratories and defense facilities possessed samples of lethal anthrax bacteria than was initially thought. But the U.S. Postal Service and the FBI will this week announce a significant rise in the joint reward of more than $2 million from $1.25 million for information leading to capture of those responsible. U.S. Army spokesman did not comment yesterday on the Hartford Courant report on missing anthrax. The newspaper said documents from a 1992 Army inquiry cited evidence suggesting someone was surreptitiously entering a lab at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick to conduct unauthorized research. One of 27 sets of missing specimens from the lab was later located in the lab, and portions of others were also located, the report said. The newspaper reported that bioterrorism experts had disagreed on the potential danger of the specimens, which were reported missing in February of 1992. Michael Langford, a lieutenant colonel then in command of the pathology lab in Fort Detrick, who no longer works there, told the newspaper he ordered an inventory after he recognized there was, quote, little or no organization, unquote, and, quote, little or no accountability in the lab. So someone apparently not only had access to Fort Detrick and the Army's Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, but samples are missing. What I will suggest in connection with not only the anthrax attacks, and in fact I've suggested this in the past, but given the documented connections between American Nazi and fascist elements and right-wing extremists and what I call the Underground Reich, and in turn the Underground Reich's connections to Middle Eastern terrorist elements, including the elements that have given rise to Al-Qaeda and quite possibly Al-Qaeda itself, the scenario that I believe is taking place here could be contemplated in terms of military strategy as a pincers movement, with the domestic terrorists constituting one element and the, quote, Middle Eastern terrorists, and they are Middle Eastern, but they're really Islamic fascist terrorists constituting the foreign policy aspect. And in turn, they are inextricably linked not only with the petroleum business, but also through that same milieu to the Bush administration and to the Republican Party in general. Recall that in the past, we've dealt with a crusade for freedom, an illegal domestic intelligence operation in which Central and Eastern European fascist elements, including at least one entire Belarusian SS intelligence unit and Baltic and Ukrainian Waffen SS elements, were brought into the United States and established as leaders in the American Eastern European ethnic communities. This operation was the godchild of Alan Dulles. It was administered by Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson for this was Ronald Reagan, and the person who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people in was William Casey, the campaign manager of the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign and later director of the CIA. Of course, Alan Dulles, with links going back to Ibn Saud and Saudi Arabia and the Arab elements associated with the Third Reich that were placed into the driver's seat with regard to Saudi oil. Now, last week we focused on September 11th as, in effect, the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it is just that. It is not only that, but it is that, among other things. I believe that with September 11th, 2001, a continuation of World War II, in fact, went from a relatively cold stage to a hot stage. And I believe that what I call the Underground Reich, through the Bush administration, and for the record, I believe that George W. Bush is a mere puppet. The Underground Reich, however, is now in the White House. They are not outside of the White House, and that makes this a very different consideration. We're going to be looking at the American domestic implications of the attacks and consider the Serpent's Walk scenario and the origin of the anthrax specimens, which appear to have come from a U.S. government lab, whether or not it was Fort Detrick. Consider also that deadly biological specimens are missing from Fort Detrick, quite a few, in fact, 27 sets of same. We're going to turn now to the San Francisco Chronicle from last Sunday. That's January 20th of the year 2002. This is an article by Allison Mitchell of the New York Times. It's headlined, Democrats Blast GOP's Partisan Spin on War. It reads in part as follows. Democratic leaders assailed President Bush's chief political advisor, Karl Rove, yesterday for telling Republicans to use the struggle against terrorism for partisan advantage by putting Bush's stewardship of the war effort at the center of their 2002 campaigns. Speaking of Representative Dick Gephardt of Missouri, skipping down, he denounced as, quote, a shameful statement, unquote, Rove's advice to Republicans at their own winter session in Austin, Texas on Friday that they could, quote, go to the country on this issue because Americans trust the Republican Party to do a better job of keeping our communities and families safe. Unquote. Well, I would add, simply as a matter of empirical fact, they sure did a great job on September 11th, and they sure did a great job with regard to the anthrax attacks. Obviously, I'm being facetious. They did no job at all. And in fact, with the connections to between the Bush family and the Bin Laden kind of family, and beyond that, with strong indications that the petroleum-related factions of our own intelligence system have certainly in the past been complicit with al-Qaeda and Bin Laden, that complicity, in fact, opening the United States up for this terrorist Pearl Harbor, I think that the partisan comments, not only by Karl Rove, but in fact the highly partisan actions that have been taken by George Bush, and some of the potentially devastating breaches on civil liberties that have been opened up in the wake of September 11th, they could very easily be seen as constituting at one level a domestic Reichstag fire, and also, in effect, nation building as applies to the United States. And again, the division between the foreign policy and military aspects and the domestic policy aspects is to a considerable extent an artificial one for purposes of time and conceptualization. And the energy business and the oil business constitute one of the major elements of overlap, as does Saudi Arabia. The New York Times of Wednesday, January 2nd of 2002 had an op-ed column by Thomas Friedman titled Let's Roll. We took a look at this column last week, and I'm going to review a section of it. After saying that he wishes George Bush were not president, even though he believes he did a good job on the war, skipping down. Quite simply, because instead of showing resolve, imagination, leadership, and creativity on the domestic front, Mr. Bush has done just the opposite. He, and I would add Karl Rove has been quite explicit about this, he has tried to use the tremendous upsurge in patriotism, bipartisanship, and voluntarism triggered by the tragedy of September 11th to drive a narrow, right-wing agenda from September 10th into a September 12th world. Indeed, and I believe that that is one of the major elements of this. And then Thomas Friedman goes on to comment, I have no problem with nation building in Afghanistan, but what I'm really interested in is nation building in America, using the power of September 11th to make our country stronger, safer, and a better global citizen in the world of September 12th, beginning with how we use energy. Well, I am of the opinion that George Bush has a not altogether unrelated view that, in fact, nation building, or really the elements behind George Bush, that nation building in the United States and having a great deal to do with the energy business is, in fact, the goal of this administration, but it is just the opposite. It is not to make us safer or healthier or a better global citizen, but rather to complete a process that I've seen at work for some time, which is to turn America fascist and also to discredit us and perhaps even destroy the United States, or at the very least get the United States balkanized into several smaller countries. Don't dismiss the possibility. What we're going to look at next is an interesting projection by Albert R. Hunt, who writes for the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, and this concerns what might have happened if Al Gore had in fact gotten the election victory that he in fact achieved, but that was stolen from him. And there is very substantive evidence that in fact Al Gore won Florida, but unfortunately we have not received the coverage we deserve in that regard. I think that in this column, Albert R. Hunt is making a very, very important point, which is the highly partisan nature of the Republican Party, despite the fact that they are waving the flag and invoking patriotism and bipartisanship. They have not only taken a very partisan view themselves, but in fact, they have done everything possible to subvert the Democrats in the past and would probably be doing a similar thing if Al Gore were president. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, November 29th of 2001. This is a column, the Politics and People column by Albert R. Hunt. It is on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, and it's titled The Gore Nightmare. And much of the first part of the column discusses how a Gore administration would be equal to the best aspects of the Bush administration and better in most, including its grasp of foreign and military policy. But as Albert R. Hunt observes here, the truth is that in the aftermath of September 11th, we're probably better off in the short term with George W. Bush, but not for the reasons usually cited. Skipping down. The real reason a President Gore would have more difficulty under identical circumstances is that the political right wouldn't have given him the leeway and support that President Bush has received. In the same situation, the vocal right in Congress would have blamed September 11th on the weakness of the Clinton-Gore policies. By the way, they've already done just that. Continuing, Jesse Helms would be ranting about the crippling of the CIA that began with Jimmy Carter and accelerated under Bill Clinton. Somehow, the Ronald Reagan, Bill Casey, and George H.W. Bush years don't count. The critics would go on to assert that capitulating to the Chinese with a semi-apology when they downed a U.S. plane only encouraged Osama bin Laden. If President Gore had waited almost 4 weeks to militarily respond, as President Bush prudently did, does anyone doubt that the congressional mullahs would have embellished the weakness charge with protests about the pitiful state of the American military? Remarkable, isn't it, how quickly this administration turned a decaying mess into a lean, mean fighting machine, just like the Kennedy administration 40 years ago when it rapidly closed the missile gap. Recent history provides a guide to the response of the congressional right once a conflict does start. In 1999, House Republicans refused to support the Clinton NATO bombing in Kosovo after it was launched. The GOP House and Senate whips Tom DeLay and Don Nichols both suggested the atrocities in Kosovo were more the fault of Mr. Clinton than war criminal Slobodan Milosevic. A few months earlier, when the U.S. bombed Saddam Hussein, Senate Republican leader Trent Lott said it was done to deflect from President Clinton's impeachment problems, presumably with the complicity of Defense Secretary Bill Cohen and General Hugh Shelton, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. On Homeland Security, there has been some criticism of President Bush, but it has been relatively mild. But suppose it had been Democrat Seth Waxman as Attorney General and Robert Mueller as the new Gore-appointed FBI Director when the same hijackers did exactly what they did. Nawak al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar, who drove the plane into the Pentagon, were on the CIA's watch list of potential terrorists. Al-Midar, the government knew, met with al-Qaeda in Kuala Lumpur nearly 2 years earlier. Yet this information wasn't shared, and both men came into and traveled freely around the U.S. In August, the Justice Department turned down a request to search the computer of a Minnesota man who sought to learn to fly a plane without takeoffs or landings and who was labeled a terrorist by French intelligence. He now is suspected of being an accomplice. I would add that that man, Zacharias Massawi, has now been indicted and is being represented by Jacques Vergès and François Genoux protégé in France, anyway, Isabelle Couton-Père. Continuing. Perhaps all this is unavoidable in an open society, but envision the harangues from Orrin Hatch about the administration's ACLU mindset that gave the terrorists free rein. Top House GOP sleuth Dan Burton, no doubt, would have found some Arab contribution to the Gore-Lieberman campaign and launched a new round of headline-grabbing witch hunts. When that fizzled, all Burton investigations do, he would have turned to a government that 8 weeks after the anthrax attack still couldn't tell us whether the culprit was foreign or domestic. By the way, this is on November 29th. It now appears that it was domestic. But again, I believe that was part of a pincers movement, and I believe that, in effect, now the Republican Party is part of that. Continuing. The full moon crowd would have gone into conspiracy hysterics if these anthrax-laden letters had been sent to Dick Armey and a handful of radio talk show hosts. Then there would have been the economic stimulus package. In addition to extended unemployment benefits, temporary tax cuts, New York City rebuilding aid, and bailouts for the insurance industry, the Gore White House might have overreached for items like more highway security, building roads, or have placated labor allies by proposing collective bargaining rights for all public safety workers. The delay Army criticism would have been vicious, yet the Bush White House, under the guise of economic stimulus, is trying to pay off all of the campaign contributors and K Street lobbyists who didn't get a piece of the earlier tax cut, a move that is far more injurious and costly. And I think this is a very, very important point that is being made here by Albert Hunt. And again, I have voiced my opinion, and it is the foundation of this series about the September 11th attacks, For the Record 325 and up, that the Bush administration is in fact a front for the Underground Reich, and that the Underground Reich attacked using Al-Qaeda and related elements, and also using domestic fascist elements as well, probably along the Serpent's Walk scenario. And I believe that the Republican behavior, the highly partisan nation building that they've engaged in, basically is a culmination of a long process in which the Republican Party has basically, in its mainstream, become fascist. The party of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Norman Rockwell has become the party of George Lincoln Rockwell. We're going to be talking about Saudi investment in the United States. Now, this is an important point to consider. In addition to the obviously profound connections between the petroleum industry and Saudi Arabia, consider that petrodollars have been recycled into the American economy for many years, and that is a very important element of the American industrial and financial and media infrastructure. Consider also that along with Japan and Germany, Saudi Arabia holds much of America's foreign debt, that foreign debt having been run up to a large extent under the Reagan and Bush administrations. This article is from the Financial Times of Monday, January 21st of the year 2002. This is an article by Rula Khalaf in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and this takes a look at Saudi anxiety over the state of the business relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. It is not just the fact that Saudi Arabia has 25% of the world's proven petroleum reserves and that America gets 20% of its oil from Saudi Arabia, but there is tremendous Saudi investment in the United States, and that investment constitutes recycled petrodollars, and again, they hold much of our foreign debt. This article reads, "While Osama bin Laden is hunted down by the U.S., the family that disowned him is joining other Saudi business people to try to safeguard Saudi business relations with the West, particularly the United States." And speaking of this conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, "In the city where Osama bin Laden grew up, businessmen have been struggling to prevent political strains from contaminating commercial ties with the West, while accusations remain that some Saudis have financed terrorism." Quote, "The businessmen are trying hard to re-engage the U.S. and get over this ugliness, and they're scratching their heads to reach out and repair the damage," unquote, said an economist, again quoting, "Some are even scared to apply for a visa these days," unquote. Skipping down again. The Jeddah Forum also put the spotlight on the kingdom's economic problems. Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, a prominent Saudi investor and the main sponsor of the conference, said the 1% annual rate of economic growth over the last decade was woefully, unquote, inadequate and would not allow the kingdom to cope with 3.5% demographic growth, 4.5% labor force growth, and growing unemployment, which Saudi officials say contributes to radicalization of the youth. And again, the economic frustration and the social injustice that exists throughout the Muslim world has in fact been a major factor that has fed what I have called Islamofascism, not to be confused with saying that Islam is fascist. That is not the case. But there is a powerful element within Islam that threatens to take charge of it that is fascist and has economic dissatisfaction as one of its main roots. And they scapegoat Israel in particular and Jews in general for their problems. And in fact, that has nothing to do with it. It is, in fact, a scapegoat. None of those Muslim countries is run by Jews, let alone Israelis. Continuing with this particular article, but the conference was dominated by the Saudis' desire to overcome the pressures of September 11th and strengthen U.S.-Saudi ties. The Bin Laden Group, one of the forum's backers, has been battered by its association with Osama. Other businessmen said they too had suffered. An official from a leading Jeddah company said a U.S. company that had bought his products for years had asked him not to publicize the relationship. Skipping down. The Saudi government has resisted calls to freeze the assets of a Saudi charity the U.S. says is tied to Osama bin Laden's networks. Businessmen said they resented the interference of the U.S. in a matter such as donations. Well, we've spoken in the past about the fact that the bin Laden family is inextricably linked with the Saudi power elite, with strong connections going back to Ibn Saud, the founder of that country, and his fascist heritage. There are also, of course, profound business connections historically between the Bush family and the bin Laden family. The actual dollar percentage of the bin Laden family officially remains small. But in fact, that relationship constitutes the relationship of petrodollars to the American economy, and that is a very, very profound relationship indeed. Note also, before we leave this, that in addition to the bin Laden family, one of the major sponsors of this conference was Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, who himself is an associate of the milieu of not only Premier Silvio Berlusconi of Italy, but also of Youssef Nader, whose assets were frozen by the United States for allegedly participating in the bin Laden network. Nader denies that. He is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and allegedly also has connections going back to Third Reich intelligence. I would note that Silvio Berlusconi isn't exactly a day at the beach in that regard either. We've spoken about the fascist heritage of Berlusconi in the past. We're going to leave this side at this time, and we're going to continue with the discussion in side two. Spitfire can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record Program 345 available within a couple of days of the recording of this program. Sister station WFMU is archived. The Real Audio program, or the For the Record programs on Real Audio, WFMU.org/Dave Emery, older programs at a longer URL linked to the Spitfire and WFMU websites. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 345, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, part two, Nation Building in the United States. This is being recorded on January 27th of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.